Can we talk about the origins? Like, so in your assessment, how do you see the origin of this virus? What do you think it is?
Right. And if your listeners are interested, there's a book that we published in September called Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon, a Scientific and Forensic Investigation, where I lay out many of the details for people. So yesterday or the day before, and I'm not sure when this video will come out, but yesterday or the day before, NIH finally admitted that it had been funding gain-of-function research. And I'm, they're throwing people under the bus right now because it's very clear to them that they've been caught on this, and we've been talking about it for a while now. So if you go back, you can see what's called gain of function research that the United States has paid for. In fact, the Department of Defense has paid for more than half of it with a gentleman by the name of Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, who made it possible to funnel federal monies from NIAID and NIH and Department of Defense and several other federal agencies to Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina and people at University of Texas, Galveston, University of Iowa, Wisconsin, you name it. There's a lot of players that have been involved in this.
Can you briefly explain what gain of function is, just briefly?
Right. So gain of function is where you take something like a virus and you change it to either make it more infective or more dangerous. Now, the premise is what you want to do is stay one step ahead of a problem. And if you do that, you know what's coming down the line. The reality is, however, if you look at the two decades worth of research and funding and even the patents that have come out of this, you see that this has not been a let's just stay ahead of it phenomenon. This is just how far can we push the envelope type thing.
Can I ask a question? Because this is interesting to me. And I know you also have a degree in law. So maybe you
yeah.
So yeah, you're in your spare time. So, but you know, obviously you know something about intellectual property, based on that experience, I'm sure. When you say patents, are you saying that they patented viruses that they created, or what's
right.
The patent?
So that's one of the big misconceptions that people have. So if you want to know what a patent is, you basically look at what's called the claims. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we put down, but the claims are what you're claiming. So when you look at all of these different things with the viruses, they're not claiming they can make a virus. What they are claiming is that they have developed a method to change viruses. Okay. And that's what these patents are. So a lot of people have read through those patents and said, oh my goodness, they're patenting life. And that's not what those patents say. Those patents clearly state that here's the process. One of the patents very specifically states when you get to it that, NIAID, Anthony Fauci's group, and NIH funded research very specifically for the gain of function or alteration of the spike proteins of coronaviruses. And it doesn't get much more specific than that.
Was it recent or was it years ago that that Fauci and his team have that patent that you just described?
That patent is sometime within the last 10 years, last 5 to 10 years, right? If you look at, and if, I think it's always interesting, people look at my history and they think, well, this guy's all over the place, where if you really look at the thread of my research, there's a continuity to it. And there's a continuity to Barrick's research. If you look at Barrick's research, he began with what was called transmissible gastroenteritis virus, or TEGF. So it's a virus that affected the gastrointestinal tract that was easily transmissible. And that's really where his work began. But then over time, as you track him, he merged into this area of coronaviruses about the same time that Xizheng Li did back in 2004. So the bashing of me by the federal government in the court case relates to the fact that the Neuro5AC receptor that I was working on for heart disease happens to be the same receptor that was critical for Xizheng Li to take her HIV glycoprotein 120 inserts into the coronavirus. That's where that attaches. Reality is you wouldn't want somebody like me working on, even though I didn't know what they were working on that same field because it's a problem for what they're doing. But it turns out it's the exact same receptor. And then the quantitative work I did in nuclear imaging exposed big pharma lies. And I get came out, you know, they came after me with a vengeance, which is fine. I'm still here, still standing, still sharing the information about what's really going on, which is what's critical. That was the time zone that Xi Zhang Li and everybody else was working on the beginning of this coronavirus. We were completing the Human Genome Project at that time. And so it wasn't known to researchers that all viruses can reverse transcribe or get into our DNA. And the way they do that is about 18% of the human genome, our genetic code, has what's called long interspersed nucleotide elements. And those elements allow viruses to reverse transcribe. So DNA to RNA is transcription. Mm-hmm. And RNA to protein is translation. So DNA to RNA is transcription. So RNA to DNA is reverse transcription. Okay. So it's the ability to take an RNA virus and insert it into DNA. And so it, we now know that this virus, SARS-CoV-2, does this in all but three human chromosomes. It's also been known in cardiology for some time that platelets, which are part of the thing that help your blood to clot, are very rich in reverse transcriptase. And we know that CD4 helper cells, which are a type of white blood cell that deal with infections, including SARS-CoV-2 and HIV, are rich in reverse transcriptase, which is how HIV gets into our what's called our T helper or CD4 cells and hides until it re-exposes itself, which is why it's a problem. Well, it turns out that it would appear that Xi Zhang Li thought that she needed the HIV glycoprotein 120 to reverse transcribe and to attach to the cell, which is how it initially attaches to the cell. And Luc Montagnier has done a wonderful job of showing that there's a tremendous amount of HIV and SIV, which is simian immune deficiency virus, or ape equivalent to HIV, human immune deficiency virus, in this SARS-CoV-2.
You brought up Luc Montagnier, who's a Nobel laureate.
Right.
And so I'm glad that you kind of cite the, you know, where his work is directly in this arena. I mean, it's very relevant to what's going on today. Do you agree with the sentiments? I mean, he seems to be really alarmed with what we've been doing. So do you agree with his sentiments around the COVID response?
Yeah, so I know Professor Montagnier McCarron, who's one of the head experts in the world in Japan for rhesus macaque research, and myself provided the three affidavits for the International Criminal Court case. So we're the ones who are providing the expert testimony behind the scenes. You know, I chuckle when people criticize Montagnier, because that's kind of, you know, this is, it reminds me of every student who ever comes into the classroom who tells the professor they're wrong. You know, it's like, okay, I don't have time for that when people come in and do that with me.
Right.
And I know Montagnier doesn't have time for the information. We just kind of chuckle. It's like, you need to learn a lot more before you get to that. So he is appropriately alerting people to concerns about these vaccines, which, you know, we have data now that I've talked about extensively that shows that the vaccines actually impair the immune system. And one thing I started to mention earlier was that in 2017, Barrick and his group stumbled across open reading frame 10 for a coronavirus. And if you insert open reading frame 10 into SARS-CoV-2, it will shut down the human immune system. With open reading frame 10 in that genetic code, you cannot make interferon, or you do not make interferon. So there's no innate immune response to protect the person, and that's the baseline. So you have innate immune response, which are the T cells that we talk about, and then you have adaptive humoral antibody response, which is layered on top of that. But you have to have that innate system, or the antibody system doesn't work. So we know that there's much more dangerous things that they can bring out. And in fact, they boasted back in around 2017, 2018.
When you say they, who do you mean they?
They being Barrick and Xi Zhang Li, that they could make a more infectious virus than they had.
So this is University of North Carolina and the Wuhan lab basically collaborating.
Wuhan Institute of Virology, right.
And they're collaborating on this gain-of-function research. And the boast was what exactly that they had?
That they could make a more infectious, more dangerous, pathogenic virus, period.
Wow.
Yeah. And Barrick was very honest in a nice Italian interview that we've shown several times, where he says, look, if we don't sign our signature to the genetic sequence that says it comes from the Barrick lab, you won't know. Mm-hmm. These are nucleotide bases. FYI, let me hit this because somebody asked me a question about this earlier. Anybody who thinks these viruses do not exist is mistaken, okay? This is not 1800s Europe where we're using Cook's postulates to get bacteria, okay? This is 2021 where we understand that every living organism is made up of nucleotide bases to make its genetic code. You define it by its nucleotide bases. Viruses live inside of cells. They infect cells and then they live inside of cells. So when you sample out somebody, for example, from the lungs, what's called a bronchoalveolar lavage, so you go in and you do washings with saline and suck it out, you then have to treat that material to get the garbage out. Mm-hmm. And then you look for the genetic sequences and you paste those sequences together and you know what's there. And so anybody who thinks that this virus or these viruses and these variants have not been isolated is simply still living in 1860 and still working with bacteria. Although I would argue that certainly those postulates have been satisfied from all the animal studies. And with the last animal study being the humans receiving the vaccine, we've definitely demonstrated that we can now transmit. You know, if there was any question about that, I think we've more than buried that. So that's the function of gain of function research. The problem is if you get too far ahead of the curve, now you've got something that's not an evolutionary change that's going to happen. You know, evolutionary change occurs one nucleotide base at a time. So for example, sickle cell anemia is a single nucleotide base. And it changes a red blood cell into a sickle cell. Now, the reason why it still exists is because there's an advantage for that. If you're in an area where there's malaria, malaria can't live in sickle cells. So it's a survival benefit for infection. However, you're certainly not going to be an Olympic athlete. So there's a trade-off there, right? So that's one nucleotide base. There are 1,770 HIV and SIV base inserts in this thing. And one of the other critical things is called the furin cleavage site, which is four amino acids, proline, arginine, arginine, and alanine. And amino acids are given a letter of the alphabet so that we can shortcut handwriting. And that's called PRRA, proline, arginine, arginine, alanine. And that's each amino acid has three bases. So that's 12 bases, not one base. And it turns out that insert is critical for the virus to attach because this virus attaches by that glycoprotein 120 to the Neuro5AC. And then it links to the ACE2 receptor. It then starts to be brought into the cell by what's called the transmembrane protein series 2 or TMPRSS2. And from there, it goes to the furin cleavage site, this PRRA site. And then it goes to neuropilin 1 and it's brought into the cell. So it's a little more complicated than just ACE2. But when you start looking at it, that glycoprotein 120 shouldn't be on there. The furin cleavage site shouldn't be on there.
So if I could just try to understand the implications of this. So we could say that basically, and obviously this is sort of a advanced biology that you're discussing here, molecular biology. But the conclusion of what you're observing and what you're sharing here is what? Is that this is a man-made virus? And is that demonstrably true or is that speculatively true?
Well, if you do the statistical analysis of the probabilities of these inserts, it's like 99.9999%. Okay. If you do the other approach, which is to say, well, if it's naturally occurring, there must be an animal carrier. Mm-hmm. Well, there is no animal carrier that's been found. There's no animal carrier that's been found for SARS-CoV-1 from 2002. Okay. If you listen to Li Mingyan, who is the virologist from Hong Kong, who got out of there and is kind of been hiding in the United States right now, she worked with people that worked with SARS-CoV-1, and she said that was a bioweapon as well. So SARS-CoV-2 is applicably named because it's kind of version 2, it's an upgrade, if you will. I think the confusion when we talk about bioweapon is people think that a bioweapon should kill the enemy, right? Well, I'm old enough that I'm of the Vietnam era, and I will tell you that when we went to Vietnam, munitions were changed to a smaller size bullet so that we didn't kill the enemy. We just maimed the enemy. And the benefit of that is that if you kill an enemy, that's one person off the battlefield. But if you maim the enemy and they have friends, their friends will come and drag them off the battlefield. So now you've taken two or three people off the battlefield, right? So it's a more vicious way, if you will, of playing war. And if you're going to develop a bioweapon, and remember the DOD paid for more than half of this research for DASAC, and provided David Franz, who'd been a former commander at the DOD, as an advisor for DASAC. So again, the DOD doesn't work with the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts. So you have to look at what they're doing. And anybody who thinks that Fort Detrick is not involved in this is a little bit delusional. So let me just kind of throw it out there for you that I received two emails requesting me as a physicist to know if I would be interested in working at Fort Detrick on funding for viruses supported by NIAID. So, you know, would I like, as a physicist, to be involved with the imaging of coronaviruses at Fort Detrick, paid for by research from NIAID? Okay, I don't know how much, you know, I mean, I really wanted to say, why did you send me these requests? I mean, are you not aware that I'm one of the people looking at you and saying maybe you shouldn't have been doing this?
When were you sent those requests?
Actually, in the spring of this year.
Wow, no kidding. So that is kind of bizarre.
It is. Yeah.
Well, maybe you should have accepted and found out what was going on over there.
You know, so that's where I think that, you know, it's one thing to get it, and it's another thing to say, yeah, let's play this game. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to do that. I'm very upfront. I'm very honest. I'm very trying to address conflict of interest. I do everything imaginable to not play these games that other people play. I mean, there's enough people playing the games. You don't need me, and they're playing in the sandbox too.
Right.
I'll just go swim in the pool.